Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock, episode 413. This week, the questions are taken from guides 486 and 487 on the Mutsuki-class destroyers and the Town-class cruisers of the First World War, the Wednesday videos on USS Lucid and how Admiral Fisher stopped World War I breaking out in 1905, and finally, the Friday video, which was the first video from the Naval History Conference I did at the start of the year about warship architecture and the projection of power. So let's get on with questions. Flop7937 asks, given their placement, destroyers essentially have to fire broadside in torpedo attacks, correct? And if so, I imagine the launch timing would have to be pretty obvious for the defender, as destroyers then have to turn away from coming in on a direct intercept course. Therefore, the defender should have a pretty good idea about when they need to change course. Were there ever attempts to give full-size destroyers bow launchers in order to mitigate this issue? Maybe in navies such as the French, with their clearer distinction between the offensive and defensive designs. It depends on the destroyer. Now, obviously, something like the forward launcher on the Mutsukis, as you can see here, has a fairly narrow arc of fire port and starboard. But the aft launcher on the Mutsuki, as you can see on more to the left, actually has quite a wide arc of fire. So even if you're talking about direct line of sight, you know, straight ahead launches, you can, with most destroyers, at least the full-sized ones from World War I and World War II, launch their torpedoes at a reasonable off angle, you know, 45 degrees or more off of your beam. On top of that, again, in the World War I, World War II period, torpedoes also have gyroscope settings, so you can get them to launch and then turn a certain amount. Now, whether it be submarine or surface launch torpedoes, generally speaking, although you could in theory have them turn at quite extreme angles, captains usually preferred to set the gyro turn at a relatively shallow angle, simply because when you put a torpedo in a prolonged tight turn, it was not unknown for the torpedo gyro to fall over or otherwise malfunction and leave the torpedo just coming back in a big circle towards the launch platform. And the placement of the torpedo launcher also affects things quite a lot. Now, obviously, again, looking at the Mutsuki class, the forward launcher, you're not going to be firing on very fine bow ahead angles. You're going to have to rely on the gyro if you want to fire mostly ahead. But there's also the factor of the torpedo is propelled out of the tube, very often by a gunpowder charge, occasionally something slightly different, but the torpedo can only fly a certain distance before it starts dropping. These are quite heavy things. So, for example, if you were going to try and fire, say, 20 degrees off of your ahead bearing with the aft launcher, there's a reasonable chance that the torpedoes might clip your deck on the way down. But if you have your torpedo launchers out on the wings of the destroyer, as opposed to on the center line, then, of course, you can actually fire at pretty fine bearings to dead ahead, and they'll be fine. The flip side, of course, is that a wing launcher can only be fired on one side, whereas a centerline launcher, in theory, can be fired on either side. And if you want to, say, in this case, have a triple launcher capability, then that means you would, if you want to be able to fire on both sides, you would have to carry six torpedoes and all the weight associated with that, as opposed to here, where you can just carry three. But there were arguments that went back and forth about this, you know, weight versus total number of torpedoes. The US, for example, was quite a fan of wing-mounted torpedo launchers somewhat later than other navies, partly because they thought that at Jutland, various Royal Navy destroyers with centerline launchers had launched all their torpedoes in an initial attack, then come back around and found a better attack opportunity and not had any torpedoes left. Whereas if you have wing launchers, obviously you can only fire one side. So if you then find a better attack opportunity, you have the other side there to go. And with the wing launchers, as I said, being able to fire relatively close to a head, they also thought that you could fire all your torpedoes on an ahead attack profile with a slight gyroscope turn and get them to all turn and obviously go past you, and then you can break off the attack. So there are ways with both centerline and wing-mounted torpedo launchers to get the torpedoes to fire ahead or very close to ahead, with varying degrees of risk with the gyros and so forth. But With that said, most destroyers did tend to end up firing their torpedoes on a roughly broadside bearing anyway, because they didn't want to get any closer to their target than they absolutely had to, because their target was usually shooting back at them if they could see them. And so you'd get as close as you wanted to, and then you'd start making a very hard turn, fire your torpedoes, and hopefully by the time you've dropped your torpedoes, you are now heading well away from your target at full speed so that you don't get shot. Now, some destroyers were equipped with basically ahead pointing torpedo launchers, some of the German World War I destroyers being the primary examples, but that did suffer from a number of issues. Obviously, it's a limited fire angle, so if you happen to come across a target that is more abeam of you, those launchers are less useful. But also, you had to have a clear line of fire from the launcher across the bow or over the bow, and that made it both the bow somewhat heavier than it ideally should be, and it also meant that water would come up and smash into the launcher quite a bit, which made them a bit of a maintenance nightmare. But as far as, you know, would the defender know to change course if they saw a destroyer suddenly slew round and, swivel its torpedo launchers in their direction and then make a run for it? Yes, in theory, but obviously destroyers would prefer to do sneak attacks. So if you don't see them launch, it doesn't matter what position or angle they're launching on, because you didn't see that. Another thing is that obviously if you have mass destroyer launches, so flotillas of destroyers coming in, you don't necessarily know which destroyer is firing at you, because remember, there's a deflection that the torpedo has to be launched at. So it's not like you'd be looking at the launcher and thinking, oh, here comes a torpedo straight at me. You'd be looking at a launcher and trying to work out, okay, well, that launcher is 20 degrees off of my current position. Is that one going to hit me, or is this destroyer that's flying 15 degrees off of my position going to hit me? And so on and so forth. Or worse still, a tactic you sometimes see being used in games like World of Warships, I know I do it quite a lot, have they fired a set of torpedoes at where I should be if I keep going on this course, and then fired another set of torpedoes at where they anticipate I'm going to dodge to? And you also get fake launches. So destroyers, if they knew the opponent could see them and they wanted to maybe get a better opportunity, or they just wanted to harass the target, they would actually even conduct fake launches to provoke the enemy into changing course and speed, and then perhaps follow up with a real launch. Maybe Duende asks, are there other ship classes that ended up wiped out in combat like the Mutsukis, particularly classes that were quite numerous? Yeah, there are actually quite a few classes that ended up being completely wiped out in combat and had a reasonable number of ships or vessels constructed. The Imperial Japanese Navy is, of course, probably the greatest repository of these, given the absolute pasting that they took during the Second World War. So, for example, here, the RO-100 class, they built 18 of them, all 18 were lost. And at least four other Japanese destroyer classes that postdated the Fubukis suffered complete hull losses across the class, although admittedly some of them only had half a dozen or so built in the first place. And there were quite a number of other classes that only had maybe one survivor. There are a number of German destroyer classes in the Second World War, for example, that ticked that particular box. There were also some batches of U-boat and batches of other submarines. So, you know, let's say a first batch of Type 2 submarines, none of which would survive the war, although some of them would be scrapped as useless, others being sunk. And then, of course, in larger ship classes, or sorry to say, larger ships that were part of a class, there were whole class losses. And the Kriegsmarine obviously being quite a victim of that, because all three Königsbergs, all three Deutschlands, both Scharnhorst and both Bismarcks were all sunk. Of course, both Yamatos were sunk. All four Kongos were sunk for the Japanese. And you even see the same kind of thing happening back in the Age of Sail. So two full sets of French 80-gun ships of the line were all either sunk or captured during the Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars, for example. And there were also several other classes of ships of the line where there was only, again, one survivor. Gary Cameron asks, how and why were the ships of various navies organized from the period 1900 to 1945? For instance, why did the British decide that a destroyer flotilla would be 8 ships plus a leader in the 1930s when they tended to have around 18 ships to a flotilla in World War One? Why did some navies have cruisers and battleships in units of 3 while others were in groups of 4, and so on and so on? Was it just dependent on the number of available ships, or was there a tactical reason? Well, going into exactly how each navy organized all of its ships in squadrons and flotillas and so forth would probably be multiple full-length videos, but very generally speaking, in terms of the smaller units like destroyers, and obviously, as you said, the destroyer flotillas in World War One tend to be a lot larger than destroyer flotillas in the Second World War, or destroyer squadrons if you're American, that was largely predicated around two things. Firstly, the fact that destroyers had gotten much larger, much more capable, and therefore much more expensive in the interwar period. And secondly, the treaties had, you know, put a limit on the number of them you could have, as well as the size, which meant that if you were using flotilla or squadron as an organizational unit to say, look, this unit of destroyers is tasked with doing this, whether it be guarding the port side of the Mediterranean fleet, screening the battle lines, screening a carrier, or whatever, you had a certain number of tasks that you needed the destroyers to do. If you don't have anywhere near as many destroyers as you used to, then you have to make those units individually somewhat smaller in order to actually have distinct units to do all the tasks necessary. And as I said, you know, sometimes it was also justified on the grounds of, well, this one new destroyer that we've built in 1935 could outfight 2 or 3 destroyers that we were building in 1905. Therefore, it kind of counts as roughly the same overall, so we can afford to have a 6 or 8 strong flotilla as opposed to a 12, 16, 18 strong flotilla previously. And also with the reduction in fleet sizes because of the treaties, there was also an appreciation that there might be a lot more independent action than there perhaps would have been in the First World War, where although there was independent action, things like the Dover Patrol and the Harwich Force and the Flanders Flotilla, etc., an awful lot of everybody's fleet destroyers in those cases were taken up with screening their big battle fleets, whereas in the Second World War, you tended to have small concentrations of capital ships all over the place, and very, very rarely did you see massive numbers of battleships all in one place, thus requiring a majority of destroyers for screening. And even then, if you did have lots of battleships, you probably also had lots of aircraft carriers, and they needed separate screening. But in terms of why some navies had cruisers and battleships in units of 3 and others in groups of 4, that tended to be down to the economics of whoever was producing the ships. Because what was generally found was that if you were going to create an operational unit of ships with the same performance and the same characteristics, it worked really well either with ships working as pairs or with ships working in units of 4. If you went much above 4, it became very difficult in an era when you're mostly relying on flag signals to actually execute successful command and control. Whereas units of 3 were actually, that they were a little bit awkward in that you needed the full signaling of a 4-ship squadron, but it was an uneven number, which made, you know, dividing up mutually supporting tasks somewhat difficult. It also meant you would be somewhat outgunned if you were facing off against someone with a 4-ship unit. And it was just a little bit more unwieldy than a 2-ship unit, but without the massive firepower benefits of a 4-ship unit. There's a lot of other reasons as well, but again, you know, we have to keep it short for a dry dock question. And so if you could build lots of ships, you would tend to go for units of 4. So even with the Grand Fleet at Jutland, although the battle squadrons themselves were notionally mostly 8 strong, or should have been 8 strong, 1 or 2 minor exceptions, then they were subdivided into divisions, and the divisions were 4 ships strong. And there's actually a very strong mirror match over in the German fleet. But in those cases, you had lots and lots of ships, and even if you didn't necessarily have four identical ships in formation, you could at least scrounge up four ships of roughly similar performance characteristics. Of course, the Americans took that a step further with the Standard class, which was supposed to have near identical speed and turning characteristics to make interoperability even easier, but that's kind of at the extreme end. And then if you weren't able to build that many ships of similar operational capabilities, then you tended to go for a unit of three simply because of the rules of three. You know, generally, if you have a ship on the front line, you'll have another ship that's either preparing to go into refit or just coming out of refit, and another ship that's actually in refit, which would mean that in the event of, you know, a crisis where you needed ships operational, you would be able to near enough guarantee that you'd always have two ships available, because a ship that was about to go into refit, if you absolutely needed it to, you could pull it out from that and keep it going for another few operations. Or if it was just coming out of refit, obviously you could rush it back into service. And that meant you would have guaranteed near enough a unit of two, with one in deep refit or repair. And obviously if one got damaged or got worn out, then you could cycle another one out and you'd still have a unit of two. And then you'd build multiple squadrons of ships in threes, because then you theoretically would be able to have multiple pairs of ships sustained when it came to combat operations. And that, for example, was certainly the thinking behind the Italians building their heavy cruisers in the interwar period in units of three, because they expected to be operating them in pairs and they wanted to guarantee that they'd have a pair available at any given time. Random guy with a beard asks, apologies if you already covered it somewhere, but could you tell us the story of the first ship to sink a submarine, which was apparently inadvertent, since one of the town-class cruisers became the first ship to sink a submarine deliberately? So if we go from the first submarines to enter service, which are, you know, the direct lineage to the modern submarines, as opposed to random submarines here and there in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, then the first of those submarines to be sunk by a ship was the submarine HMS A1, as you can see here, which, while it was out on target practice duty, as in it was pretending to shoot at surface vessels, particularly a Royal Navy cruiser, so it was on an exercise, it was accidentally run down and sunk in 1904 by the steamer SS Berwick Castle, which didn't know it was there. And That was pretty much it. It got hit, it got sunk, everybody on board died. The submarine was actually then later recovered and put back into service for a few more years because it sank in fairly shallow water. But the Berwick Castle just went on to have a fairly unremarkable life until it caught fire and burned out in Mombasa in 1919. Almirante Brown asks, in Dry Dock 381, a channel patron asked if the Dutch would have benefited from buying or building a Deutschland-type vessel in the run-up to World War II, and you answered that an alternate Panzerschiff design displacing maybe 20 to 22,000 tons with higher speed, more powerful 11-inch guns and heavier armour might have met the needs of the Dutch in the East Indies. My question is, under what strategic scenarios should a minor navy spend more money on a larger number of less capable vessels instead of buying fewer but more capable hulls? In other words, when would it make sense to buy three or four 22,000-ton Panzerschiff on steroids versus a pair of 30,000-ton battlecruisers or small, fast battleships? I think there's basically two ways in which this could make sense, depending on the situation that you're in. And obviously, different people's answers are going to vary. But from my perspective, the two kind of points at which you would want to spend money on larger numbers of less capable vessels, as opposed to my traditional answer for smaller navies, which is to spend most of your money on a few more capable vessels, is either at the very low end of things, if you are looking primarily at coastal defense. So if you're looking at mostly defending your own coastline, you're not really needing to go very far, then for small, fast attack craft like submarines and destroyers, dash torpedo boats, etc., you don't need to travel a long distance, so you can cut down on the amount of fuel that you need. And obviously that's going to reduce the size a fair bit compared to some designs. You also don't necessarily need to put quite as much effort into crew comfort if you're designing a very short-range vessel because you could have most of your crew spend most of their time ashore, and they, in peacetime, would go out for a day, maybe spend a night on their ship or sub, and then come back. And in wartime, you would essentially, you know, go out, patrol, come back, go out, patrol, come back, on a day, per day or per night basis, because your main objective is if the enemy comes, you go out, you attack them, and then either you don't come back or you do, but in either case, it's done in the same day. So if you're now able to cut down on the amount of fuel and you're able to cut down on the amount of creature comforts, if you like, the ship has come down significantly in size, which means you can also cut down on the size of the machinery for a given target speed because, well, there's less ship, so it needs a less powerful set of machinery to propel it. And at that point, even if your armament hasn't, you know, changed all that much, you might still, say, have four guns on a destroyer or four torpedo tubes on a submarine or something like that, the ship is going to be smaller and cheaper, at which point it does everything you need it to do in the limited context you're going to use it in, so you might as well build more of them, even though they're smaller and theoretically less capable than other ships that might take, you know, six guns and 10 torpedo tubes to sea for a week plus at a time. The other scenario is where you're looking at potential opponents and you realize that it would cost an absolute fortune to build something even bigger and better than everybody else's at the upper end of things. And also that perhaps it wouldn't matter so much because your opponent will just have so many of those ships, whatever they happen to be, that they'll outnumber you and take you down very quickly and easily anyway. So particularly when you're up in the realm of battleships, in say the World War I or World War II context, if you're thinking about fighting a very large navy, one, you know, even a treaty limited one, if you build one or two battleships, France, Italy, Japan, you know, Britain, America, they will massively outnumber you. So even if you somehow manage to come up with the resources and the infrastructure to build something Yamato size, well, it doesn't really matter because, you know, even the French or the Italians can come after you with half a dozen battleships, so you'll still lose. So at that point, it makes more sense to build a lesser capable capital ship, so you're not wasting the money on something that's going to even try and go toe-to-toe with a full-line battleship from a big navy, but instead, like with that panzer ship variant I suggested, you're building essentially a really big supercruiser, because then that gives you complete dominance over the next class down. So it's a lesser version of a big ship, but the next division down, you have significant superiority in, which makes you a bit of a problem for anyone trying to pick a fight with you. And of course, that's very contextual, because for the Dutch and the East Indies, the main potential threat was the Imperial Japanese Navy. In other contexts where you're just not expecting to fight somebody who has a really, really big fleet, but you are perhaps expecting to maybe fight other people with similarly sized small fleets, that's when you go back to the quality over quantity situation, which is what you see in the South American Dreadnought Arms Race. Ian Carr asks, when a number of officers are referred to as contributing to ship armament design, is this designed by committee? How senior would they have to be? And or would they have been at least in part sea-based? Now, exactly how that reference works is going to depend on who is conducting the reference to a certain degree. But if you're listening to something that I've produced, or indeed a fair number of other historians, I think, when you see the shorthand, a number of officers contributed to a design, whether it be the propulsion, the overall appearance, the armament in this case, or the armament layout, what that generally means is that obviously you have a number of officers who would be part of the design committee. Technically speaking, that is a number of officers, but usually they're kind of agglomerated into the design committee, whatever that happens to be, Bureau of Ships, Bureau of Ordnance in the States, the Directorate of Naval Construction in the Royal Navy, etc., etc. But when I say a number of officers contributed, that in particular usually means that you've got the design bureau, whatever it happens to be, and they've come up with a design, but then they go and seek the opinions of multiple other officers from other departments or other sections or or active duty officers. So it would be, for example, you've come up with a design, in this case of the Town Class Cruiser, and then your next step is to go to the Admiral of the Mediterranean Fleet and the Admiral of whatever iteration of the Home-Grand Fleet we've got at that point, and say, hey, look, we're designing a cruiser. Based on your frontline experience managing cruisers, what do you think this cruiser should be armed with? And they would give their opinions. And then, depending on exactly what they're designing and how wide a net they want to cast, as well as asking the commanding officers of various fleets, sometimes the inquiries would also go out and down to the commanding officers of various squadrons, so particular cruiser squadrons. You know, when you're doing X, Y, and Z, what kind of armament would you prefer? And you see this with destroyer armament and layout across multiple navies. They ask destroyer flotilla commanders, and in some cases even poll multiple destroyer captains to see what would you like, as well as asking the more higher-ranking flag officers. Of course, depending on what exact ship you're designing also depends on who you end up asking, because you know, if you're designing a destroyer or a light cruiser, there's a lot greater pool of people who, with practical experience with them, from, you know, individual ship commanders to squadron or flotilla commanders, all the way up to fleet admirals, who are going to have useful input. Whereas if you're trying to design, say, a carrier, it's basically going to be more senior officers and a relatively small pool of them who'll have useful design input in certain aspects. I mean, even with a carrier, you might want to poll a lot of pilots on certain things like placement and size and scope of an island. Vicky asks a series of questions, so we're going to do them in our usual quickfire style. Firstly, if a ship has three aft turrets and triple stacked superfiring isn't an option, what's the best superfiring arrangement? X superfiring over both Y and Z turrets with Y and Z mounted facing aft, like in USS Worcester. X superfiring over Y and Z with Y and Z back to back and Y facing forward, Delaware style. Y superfiring over X and Z with X facing aft, TOSA style. Y superfiring over X and Z with X facing forward, Agincourt style. Y superfiring over Z with X level with Y and facing aft, Amagi style. Or Y superfiring over Z with X level with Y and facing forward, Fletcher style. And what about the three forward turrets? I think for me, at least, it would come down to how much protection do you need to give to your ship. So for something like the Worcester, it's got, obviously, armor against light caliber shells, but it's not got tremendous amounts of armor, at which point the layout that it has, which is with X turret, i.e. the one closest to the superstructure, superfiring over the other two and everything pointing aft, that's the most efficient for getting the maximum arcs of fire for all the guns, and a fairly simple layout. And if you want to have a continuous thickness main belt, it's actually also one of the more efficient, because the middle turret can back right up to the forwardmost of the aft turrets, which means there's only really one gap between barbettes, which is going to be between the second and third turret, so the middle and aftmost turrets. But if you are looking at a battleship, then I think that changes things a little. And at that point, from a pure efficiency standpoint, I think the Agincourt layout, as you can see here on the left, is probably the most efficient, because it clusters all the barbettes nice and close together. Now, of course, that does mean, because of the forward most of the aft turrets is pointing forward, it does distance them somewhat from the superstructure and the machinery spaces. But on battleships, while it's not the rule, it's also not uncommon to have substantially more armor over the magazines than over the machinery. And in this way, by clustering all your magazines nice and close together, you can ensure that a minimal length has to be very heavily armored, and you can then save weight elsewhere. Obviously, they didn't necessarily do that with Agincourt. Agincourt was pretty lightly protected generally, but from a purely engineering standpoint, this is actually a good way of concentrating things. And yes, people might say, well, if one magazine gets hit, then they will go up. Well, to be honest, if you take a main magazine hit in a battleship, your ship's going up anyway. The only difference between this and having them more spaced out is a fractional delay in the sequential explosion instead of one massive one, but either way, your stern's disappearing, so it doesn't make much odds. For the front, it varies, again, to my mind, it varies quite considerably on whether you're doing an all-front design or you're doing a design that happens to have three turrets up front, but also turrets aft. If you're doing three turrets up front with turrets aft, and you can't do triple stack superfiring, then having the one closest to the superstructure superfiring over the other two, like you find on the Worcesters, is again probably the best bet to go for. But if you only have forward turrets, then the center turret superfiring Nelson style is probably the best way to go, because that gives you the best rear arcs while also allowing all the turrets to point forward. Second question is, where's the line between a high-end coastal defense ship like a Sveria or an Admiral Ushakov versus a second-class pre-dreadnought like a Braunschweig or Amarillo de Saint-Bon? If I had to pin it down to one specific factor set where you could point out and say, look at that, that will tell you the difference, I would say look at the draft and range. If the ship has somewhat shallow draft compared to its contemporaries of approximately the same size and scale, and only has fuel for what would be a relatively limited transoceanic range, then it is clearly designed for coastal defense. And even if you have a ship that is of a similar armament, similar armor, etc., similar size displacement, but its hull is very clearly a deeper draft design with considerable fuel reserves designed for long distance cruising overseas or in at least deep water, then it is a full-on, you know, oceanic battleship. If Greece, instead of ordering Salamis from Germany as a bespoke ship and Vasilisef Konstantinos from France as a fourth Britannia, instead ordered Salamis from Japan as a fifth Congo class and Vasilisef Konstantinos from the United States as a third New York class, on the logic of, well, no one in their right mind is going to war with Japan while they're still allied with Britain, and the US is too isolationist and Western Hemisphere oriented to get involved in a European war, so there's hardly any risk of our ships being seized during construction. What would the ships' careers look like in the two world wars, assuming they survived World War One and are modernized in the interwar period and afterwards? Well, I think during World War One they won't be doing much of anything because, well, Greece wasn't doing much of anything. And obviously all of this is assuming that Greece somehow finds the money to pay for all of this, which was historically a little bit of a problem. But assuming that they survive the First World War budgetary-wise, and then you go into the interwar period and they get modernized again with money coming from somewhere, presumably at this point they're not buying Kyklis and Lemnos, or perhaps they're selling them to, you know, get money to keep these other two ships in service. I would suspect that during the interwar period, the Vasilisos Konstantinos, the New York type, might end up getting scrapped. Yes, she is more powerful, more heavily protected than the alternate Salamis, the fifth Congo. However, I don't think even with a bit more money, Greece is going to be able to afford to both keep and modernize two big ships like this. And when they're looking over at the Ottomans, who at that point, remember, still have the ex-Gerben to their credit, I think the Greeks would probably prefer to have the Salamis to hand because she's faster than Gerben, more heavily armed than Gerben, and with modernization, she might even have similar levels of protection, maybe not quite as much, but, you know, upgrade the armor a little bit to be able to withstand 11-inch guns and you're probably golden, as opposed to the New York derivative, which, yeah, it would absolutely thrash the ex-Gerben in a fight, but the Ottoman-Turkish ship could just leave. But either way, whether they keep one or both, then when the Italians invade Greece, it's going to come down to, well, the Greeks will first kick the Italians out, the Germans will come in to help, and then at that point it's going to come down to whether or not they're going to suffer the same fate as Kyklis and Lemnos and get bombed by the Luftwaffe in harbour, or are they going to be able to get up steam and get away, much like the Georgios Averof did. Because if they do manage the latter, then Admiral Cunningham's going to be very, very happy actually to see both. More happy to see Salamis, because Salamis gives him a fast, assuming she's been modernized capital ship. You wouldn't want to necessarily take her up against a Litorio, but you'd probably be relatively comfortable pairing her with Warspite to be kind of the fast element of the fleet to go after the Italian 12.6-inch armed modernized pre-dreadnoughts. Or modernized dreadnoughts, sorry, they're not pre-dreadnoughts. The modernized New York, assuming that she's kept up her 20-1 knot top speed, is not necessarily the worst thing to happen because Cunningham was saddled with R class and such that could only about make that speed anyway. But while a slightly more solid battle line unit, because of her low speed, she would kind of join Royal Sovereign, Ramillies, Malaya, Barham, etc., at the slower and slightly less valuable end of Cunningham's fleet deployments. But they absolutely would see quite heavy frontline action for as long as they could be maintained. Crispy Nano asks, given the use of acoustic mines and acoustic homing torpedoes and how they reacted preferentially to certain frequencies, did anyone ever try to build a minesweeper or anti-submarine vessel that used paddle wheels? Would the motion of the paddle generate sufficiently different noise? It feels like something daft but plausible enough that the British Men in Sheds Division might have come up with it. As far as I'm aware, not particularly for those kind of weapons, and that's for two reasons. Firstly, early acoustic homing or acoustic detonating weapons weren't that discriminatory. They would just go for the loudest source of noise. So whether it was a screw, a paddle, or whatever, it would just home in on that. And at that point, actually, it would hit amidships, which would probably actually be worse. The other problem, a minesweeper paddles also potentially have some other advantages there, but in terms of acoustic homing weapons or acoustic detonating weapons, a paddle anti-submarine vessel in the period where this becomes more common, which is kind of, the late World War II period onwards, would have a couple of major issues because the vast, vast, vast majority of paddle ships are not particularly fast. And that would mean that things like a Type 21 could actually outrun a paddle-powered anti-submarine escort, both on the surface and underwater. And even an older sub like a Type 7 or a Type 9 would be quite hard to catch for the average paddle vessel underwater and would definitely be outrun on the surface. Now, there were some relatively swift paddle vessels, but they tended to be river vessels and vessels very specifically configured for racing, not deep ocean ships. And while acoustic discrimination did advance pretty quickly, in the early period, they would have just seen them as less capable, somewhat slower versions of a Flower class in terms of the paddle escorts, so not really wanted. The Legacy asks, if Fisher hadn't done what he did in 1905 and World War I kicked off that year, how do you think it would have been less deadly, especially considering that powered flight wouldn't have happened in time for the war? It's a bit of an interesting one. I think it'd be difficult to fully evaluate because in 1905, the submarine is not really a massively viable weapon in anything except close harbour defence. Mines and torpedo craft do still exist, but the Russo-Japanese War showed that, at least if you have some decent minesweepers with you, close blockade is still just about something that you could pull off, which is, of course, the Royal Navy's favoured strategy. And the Royal Navy has massively more pre-dreadnoughts than the German Navy does. And of course, they're about to have Dreadnought herself come online, so they have a bit of an advantage there as well. The flip side is that an awful lot of the technologies that would cause the trench fighting in World War I's machine guns, heavy artillery, etc., they're already in place. So while from a naval perspective, things are certainly looking a lot better for Britain, on the ground, and again, big caveat, not a ground warfare historian, you do have the fact that the tentative alliance between Britain and France is still very much that. It's tentative. The Russians, as we established, are not directly involved with Britain at this point. They have a separate alliance with France, but they've also just lost the Russo-Japanese War. Artificial production of things like explosives isn't as advanced, which would make a British blockade more effective, but it could go many different ways. You could have an extremely effective British close blockade forcing an early major naval engagement, which Germany loses, and with a very close naval blockade, the loss of its fleet, and possibly Fisher doing some kind of fancy amphibious landing, whether or not that particularly succeeds well or not. You could argue that perhaps that will make the war end a lot faster. But bear in mind that obviously even close blockade is a slow starvation strategy. And the flip side to that is that you could argue that with Russia having just taken a hammering in the Russo-Japanese War, while it doesn't have quite as many communist agitators as it would have by the end of World War One, it's still not in a particularly brilliant shape to immediately launch into another war in Europe. Britain may not feel particularly compelled to get involved in a land war in Europe, given the relative tentativeness of its arrangements with France. And so France might peace out separately, at which point the war might be over pretty quickly without as much bloodshed, but Germany might end up with a much more dominant position in continental Europe, while Britain has kind of crushed Germany's ambitions at sea, and you end up in a very Napoleonic situation of, yes, you control the continent, I've also taken all your colonies, and now you have no trade. Or you could end up with just a slightly more primitive version of trench warfare without quite as many of the breakout technologies that eventually helped to, you know, get to break the pattern of trench warfare. And even though Britain controls the seas, again, it's a slow starvation strategy they're pursuing. So you might end up with more or less dead. It's a difficult one to predict. Imprisoned Grover Fur asks, do you think that Imperial Germany's fleet in being strategy is somewhat unfairly maligned, given that if Italy had remained allied to Germany and Austria-Hungary, the balance of naval power in the North Sea would have become much more uncomfortably close for the Royal Navy because they would have had to devote more dreadnoughts to the Mediterranean? I don't think that particular scenario would particularly justify the German fleet build-up, simply because there perhaps would need to be allocation of capital ships to the Mediterranean, but it wouldn't actually be anywhere near as much as you'd think. Because at the start of the war, if you add up the Italian and Austro-Hungarian dreadnoughts, you'd be looking at 6, roughly, Italian and Austro-Hungarian dreadnoughts versus 4 French. And then over late 14, 1915, 1916, as St. Istvan, various Italian ships, and the Britannia start commissioning, you finally end up with a balance of 7 French dreadnoughts versus 10 Austro-Hungarian and Italian. And, you know, and this is assuming not only that Italy stays in the Triple Alliance, but also they actually cooperate to any great degree with the Austro-Hungarians, the latter of which is a lot more of a stretch than the Italians perhaps somehow staying in the Triple Alliance. So while the French would be slightly outnumbered in terms of dreadnoughts, there initially would be the pre-dreadnought fleets to consider because you've got fairly low numbers at the start. But even so, you're only talking about a difference of roughly 2 or 3 ships, which would mean that a British detachment of 4 dreadnoughts would restore the Allied balance of power pretty easily, with, you know, a 2 to 3 ship superiority, depending on the precise time period. And that's before we account for, you know, the numerous pre-dreadnoughts and semi-dreadnoughts that both Britain and France could bring to bear. And then when you look at Jutland, which is, you know, towards the tail end of things, where in terms of dreadnoughts coming online in the Mediterranean, and at that point, dreadnoughts already off doing something else, not being in the Grand Fleet. The Gallipoli campaign earlier than that had Queen Elizabeth and a couple of other major units, battlecruisers in that case, spend time at Gallipoli without overly worrying the balance of power in the North Sea. And while, yes, drawing off 4 dreadnoughts from the Grand Fleet is a battle division, one half of a battle squadron, and it does bring numbers a little bit closer, the Royal Navy, A, still has superiority, and B, they have a number of options with which to build up back up to their roughly historical superiority. So if, you know, they've seized the various ships that are already under construction, if they look around and go, okay, well, if we're going to have to send 4 dreadnoughts down to the Mediterranean just to keep superiority there, I guess we don't cancel Renown, Resistance, and Repulse as R class. We don't cancel Agincourt. And there immediately, by 1916, you've pretty much reset the balance at exactly what it was in the North Sea, possibly actually worse for the Germans, because now you've got a bunch of additional 15-inch armed battleships running around while some older 12-inch ones are helping keep everything locked down in the Med. Nicholas asks, why didn't World War II ships use their maximum speed in combat? Even considering that a fleet should adjust to the pace of the slowest vessel, the latter could still limit its speed even further. For example, when Prince of Wales was attacked by Japanese torpedo bombers, despite being capable of just over 28 knots, she still chose to cruise at 25. But during the Battle of Denmark Strait, Bismarck used its 30 knots top speed without any apparent limitation. So why are the discrepancies? Was there a practical combat speed? The short answer is that it's incredibly situational. Bismarck was using her maximum speed at Denmark Strait in part because it allowed her to retain a degree of control over how the engagement was going, as the British were quite determined to close the range and the Germans didn't really want them to do that. And she didn't really have any other operational constraints. The seas were somewhat rough, but not massively so. And the big gun turrets, which they were obviously using in combat, were able to compensate to a degree for the actions that the sea was forcing on the ships. Plus, they also had to worry about potentially the Norfolk and Suffolk catching up. And if they dropped their speed, then that would have been a lot more viable for the British cruisers, which they knew were out there. Whereas if you look at the situation with Prince of Wales being attacked by torpedo bombers, there's a few reasons why you might not want to go to full speed. Well, one is you might want to go to full speed, but it does take a while to build up to that speed. Another is that if you're under attack by torpedo bombers, if you're going at full speed, that's when your turning circle is the greatest because your inertia is the most. And given that one of the main ways of dodging successful torpedo drops is to turn, you might want to have a lower speed to ensure better maneuverability. And, you know, the difference of a 3-knot speed difference to a torpedo bomber is relatively minimal, but the difference between 25 knots and 28 to your ability to turn to try and evade the torpedoes might be quite considerable. So that would be one potential trade-off. Another potential trade-off is the fact that the anti-aircraft guns, and bear in mind you're talking about everything from light, medium anti-aircraft guns all the way up to the 5.25s, they generally are slightly more sensitive to the pitch and roll of the ship, and their targets are a heck of a lot smaller. So even if they are as stable as the big gun turrets, the slightest variation might throw your shell off so that you miss a bomber that's only got a wingspan of a few dozen feet, whereas that same slight variation just means you hit the second funnel instead of the first if you're engaging a capital ship. Jonathan Cunningham asks, when Professor Lambert discusses HMS Captain, he seems to almost discard her very low freeboard and instead seems to lay the bulk of the blame on the extra strong rigging of her tripod masts. Given that over the long haul, low freeboard went away, but tripod masts stayed, what is your assessment of Professor Lambert's assessment of HMS Captain sinking? Well, I think there's two things. One is that tripod masts don't really stick around in the Royal Navy after Captain goes down, at least on capital ships. If you look at pretty much every subsequent capital ship that the Royal Navy builds, they go back to pole masts. Admittedly, some of them are quite substantial pole masts, but the tripod mast doesn't actually make a return in Royal Navy capital ships until you get to Lord Nelson, the semi-dreadnought, the last pre-dreadnought the British built before Dreadnought herself. Which, you know, by that point, sails attached to tripod masts have long gone away. So there was definitely an aversion brought in there. And of course, as you mentioned, the low freeboard goes away as well. But actually, the low freeboard goes away before tripod masts make a return to the Royal Navy's capital ship ranks. But overall, I think when it comes to Professor Lambert's assessment of Captain versus mine, which tends to blame the fact that she's unstable as all heck, more so than the tripod mast, I think it's kind of, in a way, six of one, half dozen of the other. It's not even what I would class as a professional disagreement. It's simply one of us is, you're kind of looking at cause and effect, and one of us is looking more at cause, the other at effect, because ultimately, Professor Lambert is right in that other ships with more conventional, less strong masts and rigging had their sails blow out and didn't capsize. The fact that Captain's masts were so strong and her rigging was so strong that her sails probably stuck around a lot longer than they should have and did help in dragging her over is, you know, absolutely a fair point and something that almost certainly did happen. But at the same time, the fact that she was unstable with a very, very small degree of safe roll meant that when she was dragged over, she then sank. Whereas if, you know, if you had something like Monarch, which was considerably more stable with a similar strong rig setup, she would definitely have been pulled over a lot more than she was. Could she have foundered? Maybe, but it would be much less likely because Monarch was a much more stable vessel. So essentially, you know, one led to the other. It's possible. The thing is, it's possible that even with conventional pole masts, the pitch and roll of the ship in the storm might still have sunk Captain. The tripods made it near enough guaranteed. The flip side is, of course, that a more stable ship with tripods might also have been at risk of sinking, but perhaps not quite as much as Captain. So the combination of the two is really what absolutely kills her. It's just a question of which of the two do you hold slightly more responsible than the other. Mordred asks, how many people attended the conference and what things would you do differently if you did another conference aboard Belfast, if anything? So the attendance at the Belfast Naval History Conference was limited by the venue size. So we had the wardrooms, so we could have a maximum of 40 plus a little bit of margin for the speakers. So we sold out, which was great. Fantastic. In terms of things I would do differently, so this I left feedback forms for everyone. The single biggest feedback, I think pretty much one of the only bits of negative feedback, because I'd had a like positive feedback, negative feedback section, and in the negative feedback section, basically everybody said, can we have more time for Q&A for the speakers? So yeah, next time there will be more time for Q&A. I will definitely see to that. Or as well as that, the only other thing that I would change at this point is that the wardroom is the smallest event space that you can hire on HMS Belfast. I'd hired it specifically because I wanted to keep costs down for everyone. Because I'm aware, you know, if you attend various history conferences, price of admission does vary. And, you know, I also have looked at some conferences and gone, excuse me, you want how much? So if it wasn't for the fact that I bring books and so forth to sell at the conference, I'd actually be running at a slight loss because the amount it costs to hire, and this isn't a knock on Belfast, the actual hire rate is pretty reasonable, but the cost to hire the venue is not covered by the cost of the tickets entirely. The cost of the tickets adds up to, if everything sells out, adds up to about 80% of the cost of venue hire. I turn a very slight profit, as in, you know, enough for a decent dinner out, by selling copies of books and so forth while I'm there. And that's the reason why I chose the smallest venue on the ship, because I thought, well, the smallest venue is going to be the cheapest. Therefore, I can charge the least amount of money for people to come and attend. Therefore, it will be more affordable for people. And then I subsequently discovered that the much larger event space that can hold 100 to 120 people, which is just down the corridor, and which we almost ended up actually moving to when there was a bit of an IT snafu with the screen, that's available for hire at the same price. I'd assumed because it was a much bigger area, it would be much more expensive, but actually it's about the same price. So next time when I do, and I will be doing another history conference, but when I do another one on Belfast, I'll be hiring that room. Because A, it means more of you can come, because, well, if you sell out, that means that there are more people who want to come than can actually come. But also it'll be slightly more comfortable because it's a bigger space. And it means that I can potentially actually afford to lower the ticket price slightly, because then the event will be able to pay for itself while actually charging each individual person a little bit less, which would be quite nice. Vinve asks, according to Ryan over on USS New Jersey's channel, the Iowa-class battleships were designed with a 25-year lifespan in mind. How about HMS Vanguard? As far as I've been able to work out, the Royal Navy tended to operate on a 20-year cycle for the time period of dreadnoughts. Partly, admittedly, that was driven by the fact that, well, the Washington Naval Treaty and subsequent treaties had replacement timelines, which called for a ship to be at least 20 years old by the time it was replaced. But when you look slightly further back in history, so to the sort of late pre-Dreadnought and early Dreadnought period, neglecting, of course, the mass scrappings that you get at the end of World War One and running up to the Washington Naval Treaty because things have been worn out, you tend to see this approximately 20-year lifespan come in. And that's mostly on the grounds that by the time you get to around about 20 years, assuming you haven't done huge amounts of wartime steaming, the machinery plant in a ship is going to need major overhaul and most likely probably replacement. And at that point, given the amount of work you have to do, as we've discussed in questions on previous dry docks, to cut down into a ship, especially a battleship, to extract the relevant bits of machinery and put new machinery in, the cost involved, unless there's some strange external factor influencing things, isn't actually worth it. Now, if you're talking about, you know, the mid to late 1930s with the modernizations and the fact that the Washington Naval Treaty has artificially held battleship design down to a point, at that point it is worth it because those units can still be viable frontline combatants for 5-10 years or so after those refits are done. But in the normal course of things, with normal battleship development and technology development, at about 20 years old, a battleship will be so outdated and outgunned by the newest stuff that's coming online that the amount of money you'd have to spend going into stripping it all out, replacing its machinery, rebuilding it, etc., you might as well spend that on a brand new ship because you might spend a bit more money, but you'd get far more capability for it. So from what I've seen, the Royal Navy was planning on a roughly a 20-year life cycle for Vanguard, so she would have been around and then got replaced in the mid-60s, all else being equal. With the Iowas, it's a bit more understandable that they might have been designed with a little bit longer in mind, in part because the US tended to try and keep its ships around a little bit longer, which was something of an artifact of the fact that they had a slightly smaller fleet in the first place for most of the time period that the channel covers. But also, of course, the Iowas were significantly larger, significantly more expensive investments than, if you like, the line ships of the North Carolina and South Dakota classes. So given that it was a jumping capability, it would make sense the Iowas would remain competitive a bit longer. DM Phoenix asks, during the steel warship era, most of the ship's men worked below decks in isolated areas like boiler rooms and powder magazines. Is it generally the case that these men would have no idea what was going on during the battles raging around them? Were thousands of men clueless as they just stared blankly into bulkheads for the entirety of Jutland or the Battle of Denmark Strait? Or were the senior officers giving some sort of sports-like play-by-play over the intercom to keep the crew appraised of the situation? It varied quite considerably. Some ships genuinely did have officers who were narrating a play-by-play over the ship's tannoy system, partly because the officer could and partly because they thought it was a good idea. But in other cases, which would be more common, you wouldn't get a play-by-play. But you wouldn't be entirely clueless as to what's going on, because very often ships' captains and or the first officer, whoever had been designated, would usually give some kind of briefing to the men ahead of a major engagement because they knew roughly what was going on. So, for example, when Scharnhorst was out for what would turn out to be the Battle of North Cape, everyone knew she was out. Everyone knew that they were sailing into a potential battle with Scharnhorst or something like her, and therefore pretty much everybody was briefed, even if it was just very briefly, by the ship's command staff as to, you know, why we're out here, what we're likely to encounter, and potentially even when they might be likely to encounter a particular target. The same thing with things like, you know, the hunt for Bismarck or whatever. But that would give you some information about what was going on and why, but not a play-by-play. Beyond that, during most of the battle, the people who'd get the relevant information were the people for whom it was necessary to know that information. So there's accounts of, for example, people who were on HMS Belfast during the battle with Scharnhorst, and they knew that they were going into action with Scharnhorst because they'd been told, like I just mentioned. But during the battle itself, from their action stations, all they'd really know would be, oh, right, the engine room is sounding a bit more active, we must be going faster. Or they'd hear and feel the thump of the guns going off above them and say, oh, we're firing at somebody. Cool. And that's really all they would know until some major announcement was made, or indeed the battle was over and everyone was told what had happened. But obviously there'd be kind of interim sections in that because, for example, if you're trying to explain to the engine crew what you want to happen and why you want it to happen, then at that point you need to give at least the people that you're contacting over the phone or over the voice pipes a bit more information as to why you're asking this, because that can help them decide how urgent it is. Because obviously if you just say, oh, we want to go full ahead, well, does that mean we want to go full ahead at the normal rate, or, you know, are you being chased by a torpedo, or is there a lot of enemy shells landing near you and you need to move right this instant, etc., etc. So this kind of information could be communicated to, in that case, obviously the engine crew or something like that. And similarly, although again, it's not necessarily 100% standard practice, if you're engaging multiple enemy ships, like say at the Battle of Barents Sea, you might receive orders down in the shell rooms and in the magazines to switch ammunition types, and it might be prefaced or suffixed with something like switch target enemy destroyer load HE, something like that. At which point, we're firing high explosives because we're firing on a destroyer, but you know, a little bit later you might receive the order to switch to armor piercing. And it's not necessarily that you need to tell people specifically why you're doing it, but if you are getting, you know, slightly garbled orders because no communication system is going to be perfect while the guns are pounding away and people are running around hauling shells, etc., it could be very easy to misinterpret something if someone just phones up and says, yeah, we want high explosive now. Oh, now we want armor piercing, etc. Whereas if you just preface it with, you know, switch target to enemy cruiser, load armor piercing, it's very, very obvious that this is not a mistake. Fraser's far fashion forfeiter for four fee fifes fairly farthing forsaken for final fee foreclosed forlorn asks, what are your favourite nautical novels from the 19th century and why? I mean, if we're going by novels in terms of fiction, then the only 19th century nautical, or at least nautical adjacent novel that I've read to any great degree is War of the Worlds, which of course right at the very end of the 19th century and only covers naval matters for a small portion of it. And to be honest, it's basically for the same reason I haven't read much 20th and 21st century nautical fiction literature, simply because, well, reality is vast and has an awful lot of interesting stuff to read about. And, you know, I only have so many hours in the day. And at that point, reading either factual accounts or sometimes semi-fictionalized accounts of actual voyages, to me, is just more interesting than the majority, not all, but the majority of nautical fantasy or fictional literature. Alex Cheng asks, aside from Master and Commander, are there any instances in media where you were impressed with the use of naval terminology, and any particularly bad examples as well? There's a whole slew of naval films in the 50s and 60s that use perfectly spot-on naval terminology, things like the Battle of River Plate here. And to be honest, that's in large part because they're either using actual Navy sailors or retired Navy sailors, either directly in the film as actors or very heavily influencing the script and what's being said. And obviously in the Battle of River Plate, they even had one or two of the ships that had actually been in the Battle of the River Plate and the associated surroundings that actually, you know, being filmed. Obviously, they couldn't use Exeter or Graf Spee because they'd been sunk. But Achilles and Cumberland both played themselves, and they actually used real-life warships to play everybody else. But with that said, you know, as time goes on, things drift a lot more. And I would say that the vast majority of naval series, films, etc. in modern media in the last 30 years have played very fast and loose with naval terminology. Obviously, Master and Commander being something of an exception. There are a handful of others, but most of the time when I view that kind of media, I tend to just switch off the part of my brain that's looking for really, really accurate naval terminology because I know I'm not going to get it. And if it does show up as very accurate, I'm like, oh, that's a pleasant surprise. But yeah, most of the time, I'm just not expecting to see any. So I'm also not really that surprised if it's bad, and therefore usually really bad examples don't stick out in my mind because I'm not expecting them to be any good. Jesus Hinojosa asks, Dakar, the capital of Senegal, had a French naval facility that sided with the Vichy government after the French surrender. Could having a Free French base at Dakar have given the Free French Navy better support options and prevented the scuttling at Toulon and the British attack at Mers el Kébir? Well, as I've pointed out before, there was actually a significant fear in the Vichy government that the high officials in Dakar would actually defect to the Free French, to the point that one of the very first things they actually did was put a bunch of new senior officials, both civilian and military, on a plane and send them hurtling down to Dakar on the hope that they'd get there first, replace the officials, and then when the British showed up, then obviously the area would resist, which they managed to do. It's one of those, you know, little what ifs, you know, what if that plane crashed? What if it was delayed? What if something happened to it so that the British forces got to Dakar first and it switched sides, because that would have brought Richelieu and a bunch of other ships to the Allied side. Now, if we hypothesize on the basis of your question that that did in fact happen, let's say the French transport goes down in the Mediterranean and all our board are lost and it takes a little bit of a while for the Vichy French to figure that out, and thus Dakar defects to the Free French, it's all very much dependent on the timing. Because for obvious reasons, the British went after Dakar after they'd gone after Mers el Kébir, which obviously then meant that there was very little chance that Dakar was ever going to come over to the Free French side. Even the later operations toward the end of 1940 under de Gaulle's instructions also didn't achieve anything. However, if when Richelieu initially sailed for Casablanca and then Darlan ordered Richelieu to turn back because he thought Richelieu might be defecting to the Free French, when this was before Mers el Kébir, if in fact Richelieu had been defecting to the Free French and met up with some British units at sea and showed back up off Dakar and was just like, hey, I've got the biggest guns in the area, also I'm French, but we've decided to join the Free French, so Rear Admiral Plancon, why don't you also follow us? And they'd done that, then you might see something slightly different happening at Mers el Kébir, because broadly speaking, Jean Soul and Plancon were both under similar orders from Darlan as to what they should do with their ships if it was not necessarily possible to keep them fully under French control. And if at that stage the British had shown up off of Mers el Kébir and been able to say, well, hey, look, the latest and greatest battleship in the Marine Nationale and the entire naval base at Dakar have already decided that a correct interpretation of their orders is to continue the fight against Germany, I mean, it might not persuade Admiral Jeansoul. Jeansoul might still just go, no, I'm going to do exactly what I did historically, but it might prevent him from going down the route that he went down. It might give him an option that he might then choose to exert, or indeed, if the British choose to make it known to everybody, much as Cunningham appealed to the general French sailors in Alexandria, then in both Mers el Kébir and Alexandria, you might end up with cases where the general populace of the French forces there in both ports might turn around and say, well, hang on a minute, look. If Dakar and Richelieu and all the forces there have decided to go Free French, I think we should too. And that might force the hands of both the admirals in Mers el Kébir and in Alexandria, which, of course, would result in a fairly major Free French formation right from the start. It's not really going to do much about the scuttling of Toulon other than possibly affect which ships are actually there, because, of course, Toulon is Vichy French held, and so whatever ships would be there, even in the event of Dakar going over to the Free French pretty early, they're still going to scuttle themselves. It's just that, you know, Dunkirk and Strasbourg, etc., probably won't be there because they'll be flying under Free French colours. And finally for this week, Paul Goyne asks, in general, how useful were the various coast defence battleships of the second half of the 19th century? Unfortunately for most of them, it's almost impossible to quantify because for the vast majority of them, they were never called into action. At which point, you know, you could make the argument that they were clearly wastes of money because they weren't needed. But equally, you could make the claim that they very clearly served their purpose because they weren't needed. You know, so either no one was planning on attacking these people, and so it was a massive waste of time and money, or maybe someone was thinking about attacking them, but because they existed, people just decided to go off and attack someone who was a little bit easier. And yes, a few of them did end up getting engaged in the early 20th century, but obviously that was well past their time. It's a bit unfair to judge their performance on a period with just that they just were not designed to fight in. There were a few, though, that you could say were definitely a waste of time. So the Rupert and Conqueror classes in the Royal Navy basically were thrown together because that's what the budget allowed for, and there were scares at the time about needing coastal defence. But honestly, the Royal Navy could have gotten a lot more service out of just using that money to build one or two additional normal battleships of the period. Basically, outside of building a slightly interesting gunnery tender, there really wasn't much point to building those things. Whereas, conversely, just purely from a morale perspective, having the Cerberus in Melbourne was a huge boost to everybody there. And then, of course, you have the occasional times, admittedly this is also straying partly into the 20th century, the very early 20th century, but when you look at the Spanish-American War and the Russo-Japanese War, various attempts to move what were either partially or wholly coastal defence battleships around as if they were ocean-going battleships to fulfil various missions generally ended in various flavours of failure. So trying to use them at sea or having them if you're a big navy, pretty pointless. For small to medium-sized navies or at very, very far-flung outposts, as I said at the beginning, it's kind of a qualified by how exactly do you evaluate ships that never really fought in that many engagements, if any. And that brings us to the end of the dry dock for this week. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.